SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We acknowledge the people of Ngāi Iwi, of Te Wai Pōnamu, Aotearoa, who welcomed Alone Australia onto their land. And we acknowledge the Cammeraygal people as the traditional owners of the land we're recording on. We pay deepest respect to First Nations elders, past and present, and all First Nations people.
Welcome to Alone Australia, the podcast. My name's Darren Mara from SBS World News and also SBS Dateline. I'm a huge fan of Alone. I'm also a huge fan of the woman sitting opposite me, Gina Schick. How does it feel to be back on the Alone trail?
Hi, Darren. It's amazing. I'm a long way from the wilderness sitting in a podcasting studio, but I'm so excited to be hosting the podcast for Series 2 of Alone Australia and discovering all about the next crop of participants.
We'll be watching season 2 of Alone Australia with you. We'll be breaking down all the action. We'll be chatting to the participants. This podcast will be your official and essential companion to the show.
It's also going to fill in some of the blanks as we go behind the scenes and into some backstories and things you're not going to see on the telly. I'm super excited to be chatting with Rima later. She's the EP of Alone Australia. And if there's anyone who's got the skinny, it's her.
I can't wait.
We're going to be asking participants all sorts of questions, and we need you to give us a hand. So send in your questions to alonepodcast@sbs.com.au.
If you haven't watched episode 1, stop listening to this podcast, go and watch it, and then come right back here because this is full of spoilers.
Yeah. You really don't want to break this for yourself.
No. Let's set the ground rules of what this show is.
If you haven't watched Alone, the premise is there's 10 Aussies of dubious sanity dropped into some ridiculously harsh winter landscape to survive for as long as they can on their wits and 10 survival items that they get to choose from a basic list.
Mm.
They're completely solo, they're filming everything themselves, and the only way they can get out is to basically tap out, be medically extracted, or someone they love jumps out from behind a bush to say, by the way, you've just won $250,000.
So last season you kicked ass in Tasmania. This season we're in New Zealand. Let's talk a little bit about the location, some of the differences. What are your first impressions of where they've landed?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've watched it as well. It's a really different environment, isn't
Heaps.
It?
Oh, well, Tassie was a bit bleak. Like, yeah. Beautiful. We love Tassie, but it was a bit bleak.
It was very bleak.
We're not getting bleak vibes from New Zealand.
No, I am so jealous. I was watching that shouting at the TV because it looks so beautiful. I must admit, for that first episode, I'm thinking, oh, my God, they're just living in clover.
Mm.
However, for all of that beauty, what you've got with that is actually a whole bunch of challenges as well. And one is the beauty, because the environment is so incredible, you can almost get lost in it, especially when you've got drop shock of just being, you know, landing out there and wondering what the hell you've done. But the other thing is it's incredibly wet. It looks comparable to Tassie, doesn't it? And it's that same kind of bush that we had
soaked.
Yeah, completely soaked. Mm. I can remember like literally wringing out sticks, and they're doing the same thing there. It looks that wet. So I reckon that fire could be a bit of a problem. Another thing is that it looks like it's quite dark. So I don't know how much rain they get, how much cloud they get, but I'm not seeing much sunshine for the participants that we've met. And that is a huge, huge challenge when you're out there, just not to have sun.
Talk to me about drop shock, which you just mentioned there. For the layman like myself out there, what is it? And, I mean, is it something that you think all the participants will be experiencing?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, drop shock is absolutely real. So imagine sort of taking yourself from your nice comfy house and your comfy chair and your comfy car and your comfy job and your comfy life where everything is comfortable, and then shaking all of that up, taking you completely out of that, and then throwing you into the middle of an ecosystem that you don't know.
Mm.
You don't know this place, and now you're starving, and now you're having to solve problems, and there's no way out. it's a situation that pretty much everyone who's out there has never been in before.
Yeah, because it's their survival skills have been, I suppose, cultivated in what is now a foreign land.
Yeah. And most people's survival skills don't involve that much isolation. So most people, when they're training, they might go out on a weekend or they might have food with them. But the combination of all of that means that drop shock can result in almost instant paralysis and all your plans going out the window.
Sure. And then there's the challenges of the environment, right? The first thing that struck me was the sand flies.
Oh, my God, the midges. Midges. Yeah. It's like, do you know Aussie sand flies?
Yeah, within reason, yeah.
Yeah. You've ever been nailed properly by them?
I have a couple of times. In fact, I had an autoimmune response to a bunch of bites on my leg once.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what you went through with that is probably similar to what they're all going to go through with the sandflies or the midges in New Zealand. I got nailed by them a few years ago and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm used to the sandflies in northern Queensland. I mean, they itch, but you just don't scratch. It'll be fine. So I let them bite me all over. And within 4 days, it looked like the back of a cane toad all over my hands. And the welts lasted for literally weeks. Just seeing how many midges there are, I reckon they're going to run into some serious midgy issues out there.
The other big difference between season one, season two is bow hunting is allowed.
Oh,
is that a huge game changer?
Massive, massive game changer. In season one, we weren't allowed any projectiles at all, which meant that we had to basically run up and smack something in some way or live trap, which is almost impossible. These guys are allowed to have a bow and arrow. Now, it's really easy to think, oh, they've got bows and arrows and there's deer everywhere. Everybody's going to be, you know, living large. But the thing with these bows and arrows is they're not a compound bow. They're not high tech. These are recurve bows and they're a primitive hunting weapon, which means that they don't have a huge range. So you have to be able to stalk up to the game without it smelling you or hearing you. You need to have those skills of stalking. You need to be able to camouflage your physical look and your scent. You need to be able to put yourself into the behavior of the animal. You need to know its patterns. You need to have the actual skill of a kill and a kill shot, because if you hit in the wrong place, it can just take off in the bush. It's a really massive set of skills. And just being good at hitting an archery target doesn't make you a good hunter. So even though they've got the bonus of bows and arrows, this is a really, really, really hard thing to nail.
It seemed like a really dense environment too. If you have a line of sight to a deer, I mean, you're also contending with branches, with trees, all that kind of stuff.
And also making noise and, we've got an Australian champion, Tamika, I think.
Tamika, yeah.
Yeah, so we've got Tamika and we've got what looks like some pretty amazing hunters. So hopefully we get to see some hunting action, but I'm also not going to hold my breath.
We met five participants.
Yeah.
We met Tamika, Rick, Mike, Chase and Leanne.
Hmm.
Let's start with Rick. I've got kind of like Uncle Rick vibes.
Oh, my God. Rick's great, isn't he?
Yeah, he got his gear off and he had a swim, had a bit of a meditation as well.
And then the swim, that's a ballsy move straight off the bat because, of course, in these cold environments, like conservation of energy is the most important thing. And here he is getting his kit off and getting into freezing water.
Yeah.
Like, why do you reckon he might have done that?
I don't know, like connect with the land, feel a bit of freshness. I mean, perhaps it could help some relations there with drop shock. I mean, getting
That's
in the
true.
Water and
yeah,
just trying
yeah.
to reset the body.
Yeah, I guess like ice baths.
Yeah,
as well. It's like, whoo-hoo, we're here. Yeah, well, I see it as a connection with the land as well. We've got him coming in later on.
We certainly do.
Let's ask him.
Let's ask him
That'd
about
that. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. Tamika, right, she has a plant-based diet, though she has said she'll start with fish. I want to know, like, can you win alone if you're not eating meat?
Mm. If you put enough weight on to be able to just weight everybody out and chew your own body fat, then yes, you could technically win on a plant-based diet. But basically what takes us out in terms of starvation is fat. Like, we need fat, and you're never going to get enough fat from a plant-based diet. You need animal protein and animal fat to sustain you through starvation and not have organ failure.
We met Leanne, who is the partner of Rob from season one. Do you think that'll be a bit of an advantage for her, having that knowledge from season one?
Yeah, I reckon so, but it might also be a disadvantage. I'm really, really pleased to see her in here as well. you can immediately see her connection with the land and her sort of coming in with the connection with the ancient spirit of the land. And the other thing I think is she's incredibly motivated because she wants to be able to have a parcel of land for her and her family. So I'm going to be curious to see how she goes with that.
Mm, feels like an enduring goal that could carry her through moments where she's lacking
hope.
Yeah,
yeah. But the other thing is, and this is something that I see with pretty much all First Nations people, both on and off the show, First Nations people are used to being with mob. Like, your mob is your survival item. And so to be solo is a huge and probably, like, completely perplexing thing. Like, well, why would we be on our own? So, yeah, I hope that she can find her way, whatever that is.
Sure. And we have Chase as well, who found something that ended up tasting like asparagus. It's good, I guess, to know that you've got that in your environment if you really need it.
And he got it really quickly too.
Yeah.
Well, like, so, you know, in the first day or two, he found plant food. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, that's got to be good for your self-esteem.
Yeah.
He didn't seem too impressed by the asparagus.
No, he didn't. He didn't. Mike ended the episode on a bit of a cliffhanger, having some breathing difficulties. What's the general protocol there? I mean, just like the evac team's going to come in. What do you think's going to happen next episode with that?
Yeah, like looking at how distressed Mike is, and also, you know, what we see with Mike is like he's in a really unfamiliar place. There's an unfamiliar bird. He doesn't have that relationship with his own home country. And it sort of highlights something about survivalists as well. We learn in an ecosystem. So you can be the most expert survivalist, but basically you're an expert survivalist in the ecosystem you know. You can have skills that translate. But when you're somewhere that's completely different, everything is kind of scary. And I think what we see with Mike is, it looks like a medical emergency, and then he's called for help, which means they're going to be coming in to make sure that he's okay. And with chest pains, you don't want to muck around. I hope he makes it through, but I think with that level of distress, this might be it for Mike, and I guess we just have to wait and find out.
Fingers crossed for Mike. Watch episode 2.
Yeah, can't wait.
We are here with Rima Dayer. She's the executive producer of Alone Australia. Rima, you sweat over the minutiae of this program from well before the cameras start rolling until the season finale goes, and we want to try and get some of the juices out of you today.
Yeah, actually, we want the secrets. Now, you hold it all pretty closely, pretty tight to your chest, but we're going to try and pry it all out of you. How do you feel about that?
Nervous as all hell.
No need to feel nervous. We're all friends.
Yeah, so a little sneak behind the curtain. And then if you get a little bit too close to some of the stuff we try to hide behind the curtain, I might call out bananas, which you'll be familiar with, Gina. It's one of the things that we prep our participants with if they ask a question that we can't necessarily answer.
That's the safe word.
Safe word's bananas. Mm. Then everyone understands we've hit a zone. So you can bananas me or bananas you.
Okay.
Is that all right?
There'll just be bananas everywhere.
Yeah.
Mm. I like bananas.
Perfectly. First question, the one that I get asked all the time when I'm out, is how alone are the participants really?
As alone as you can possibly get, and that's one of the key features of our location search when we're looking for somewhere to make the series, which, as you can imagine, is difficult in this day and age. We're building roads, we're building infrastructure, and wherever there's somewhere pretty, we're sticking holiday houses or trying to make that area a tourist area. So it's getting harder and harder to find those spots, but they are alone. They are isolated. We make sure that there is no line of sight to any other people, to any other activity. We make sure that there is no light pollution, no noise pollution, and that they have no way of bumping into each other. So it's as alone as you can possibly get.
No film crews.
No film crew. Mm. It's all self-documented.
Mm. This season, a lot of the participants are a lot further apart from each other than they were in the first season, like dozens and dozens of kilometres. Is there a reason for that?
It's purely location-based. Mm. So as far as we can spread, we will spread our participants. So you're limited by the overall geography that the season grants you, and we happen to be in an area where we had a lot more room to play, so we spread them as far as we possibly could.
But does that then mean Because when they tap out, you've got to be able to get to them in an emergency. And for season one, everyone was clustered pretty closely. But in season two, they're over like a wide distance. Does that then create a logistical problem for safety, getting them out in an emergency?
It does. So you have to recalibrate your safety based on the series that you're making. So you bolster things, you make sure you have more response teams, first responders, and you're able to get to everybody within a suitable amount of time. And you also have state emergency services on standby in case you can't, because safety is paramount. If you can't get to them, someone has to.
Mm. So how do you actually choose each of those locations for the participants?
It's a very long, slow process. It takes months and months, and we conduct what we call our ground truthing exercise. So we choose the sites for a whole range of reasons. We need to be able to access everyone by boat, so access is really important. Editorially, we want the sites to look great. We want variation between the sites. But ultimately, the ground truthing exercise means that we have a whole range of sites. We have more than what we need. We get onto the land with a team of experts, and they are survival, safety, flora and fauna experts, ecologists, who will go and examine each of the spots that we've picked, and they will scour those sites. They will make sure that they're safe. And then what we're doing is we're choosing the 10 most on par sites in terms of what they can offer for survival. So food, water, shelter, resources. As you can imagine, you can't give everyone equal sites. Mm. So you have to make sure that they are as closely on par to each other as possible. And then that's how we narrow down the final 10.
So when your team goes out and does that, and then at some point you have to personally go and walk the ground, what were your first impressions when you got to this incredible location that I am so jealous about? What was it like for you the first time you stepped onto that ground?
Honestly, I got there before my teams did. So I was the first person on there, just me and a skipper driving around having a look at all of these places. And honestly, from before I even got on the boat, it was breathtaking. It's eye candy, isn't it? Every which way you look is a postcard. We were so lucky to be where we were. It's almost overwhelming. Every which way you look is just the most stunning scene, and the scale of the place. Everything is higher, wider, deeper, greener, denser, in some spots colder, windier. So it was just a step up in terms of the way that that landscape attacked your senses. But it was beautiful.
So in the first episode, everyone was laughing at me because I was swearing at the TV going, oh, my God, you lucky bastards, I can't believe you've got this. It was like my ideal dream of what Alone would be when I went out there and wasn't.
Sorry.
But of course there's going to be challenges in any location. And so what were the challenges on this one, and what were the different challenges to series one?
They are completely different challenges, and in some ways you might look at that when you first look at that location. I can see why you were like, thanks a lot,
yeah.
Season one. Because it is breathtaking and it's beautiful, but it has its own set of challenges, and there are restrictions that govern the way that you are interacting in every place that you are. So every season's brand new with its own set of challenges, and I think this one in particular, some of those challenges were, you know, the weather was more severe than in season one in some ways. The density of the landscape was very similar in terms of that cold rainforest environment, so you'll be very familiar with that. That challenge remained the same and just as intense. It's wet and it's cold and you can't get things dry very easily, and the landscape is dense, the vegetation is dense. So that challenge remained similar. What stepped up, I think, in terms of the challenge was because you have a much deeper lake, there are new fishing challenges. So the way you fish and the techniques and the methodologies that you employ change for this type of lake.
Let's talk about the participants. How do you choose them? What are you looking for?
A whole range of things, to be honest. At the very base level, competence. We need to know that we can safely put these people on the land and they can look after themselves. And that doesn't necessarily mean the same level of competence. It means a basic level of competence. And that competence is not just a physical competence in terms of them able to keep themselves alive. It's an ethical competence as well. We need to make sure that they align with the whole idea of Alone, which is to celebrate nature and to live sustainably with it. We talk about the struggle against nature all the time because it's a lot more dramatic, but really what this show proves time and time again is that living with nature is the joy of what we love seeing in this series when people are successful in that environment. So we want people who come in with that attitude as well. And the joy of working with SBS is the importance of representation. So we want to make sure that everyone sitting at home watching this series sees someone that they identify with. and someone who represents them, because we've got this mindset, I think, that survivalists are a particular type of person and a particular gender and a particular age and of particular training. But what we've seen, thanks to this particular woman over here, this wonderful creature, is that there's different approaches to survival and there's different mindsets and there's different strengths to be celebrated. And all backgrounds bring their own thing to survival and all of them are equally valid. And all 10, no matter how long they stayed on the land, brought something to the table in terms of that representation and the teaching. So we want that. That's really important when we're looking for people, that their stories will educate and that their stories will enlighten and that their stories will speak to everyone sitting at home on the couch.
One of the things that I've kind of noticed with that, having been in it, but also now sort of, you know, getting a little sniff for series two, is that the Australian version of Alone has a different flavour to the Northern Hemisphere versions of Alone. I'm really curious as to like how deliberately you went to find an Aussie flavour.
Do you know what? I'd like to say it was deliberate, but it was only deliberate in the sense that we actively made the decision not to make the American show. We just said, let this show be organic. Let the participants step up and do their own thing. And that's the only conscious part of it, because you have limited ability as a producer really to shape this series. Apart from in post where we stitch all the stories together, really, it's what you guys do out there. And so it organically happened. I mean, Aussies are Aussies and we have our own way of doing things. Lucky for us, it did bring a flavour that people responded to, which is fantastic.
I find it interesting, season one in Tassie, I mean, you're talking about Australians on Australian land. I take it that not many, or yeah, and you might maybe from that particular part of the country, but there is an inherent connection to country you get, right? Whereas now you've got Aussies over in New Zealand, it's a foreign land, it's a different climate, different conditions. Was that a factor in choosing New Zealand over Australia this time?
Yes. We wanted to level the playing field yet again, but also, and I can't lie, the appeal of being able to bow hunt was a big one for us. And just to have a look at what that methodology did to the gameplay. Did it change things for people? Did it mean that they were going to eat better or more? Did it change the way that they tackled their strategy on day one, you know, versus season one? Were they, are their priorities the same? And psychologically, does it affect the participants in a different way? So, yeah, bow hunting was a big, big appeal for us.
I can't wait to, like, see how that plays out as well. I want to ask you all the questions, but, of course, that's bananas. You can't let us know how that plays out. So I'm very curious to see how the bow hunting thing
pans out. I'm really curious to know what kind of prepping the participants get before they go in. I mean, what, particularly with all the camera gear. I mean, they have to lug around, what is it, 100 kilograms of camera gear.
Just a light pack.
Yeah, of course. But also like...
through that terrain as well.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you've got the survival aspect of it and then you've just got this, like, you're a pack mule essentially and a camera person. I mean, do they get training and all that stuff?
They do, but not much. Not as much as you would like to give people when you're trusting them to make your entire series for you. It's a little bit of insanity on behalf of the producers, really.
But, and not as much as we would want as well to make it when we get out there and realise we don't know how to turn on the camera. The audio is just a completely baffling computer thing that doesn't make sense. And where do we even put the microphone?
How fun are mic packs? Yeah, and look, they have to charge their own batteries while they're out there as well.
How do they charge the batteries?
We had someone in Tasmania, an amazing technician, build a Pelican case for us that has a car battery inside it, and it has all these ports that you attach all the chargers to. So charging everything overnight.
And let me tell you that a car battery weighs a lot when you're starving and you've got to lug it across country as well.
We just want to make it, you know, easy for you guys. It's a week of training before everyone goes in. We call that week boot camp. So it's about 5 or 6 days that crams in a lot of information. We try not to train too much, to be honest, in terms of survival.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, they're really happy about that.
But surely most participants have already got more than the basic survival skills, so you're not training that really,
no.
Are you?
No. And we don't want to take an edge off anyone either. So if you go too far into foraging, for example, or hunting or fishing with training, what you're doing is you're taking someone's edge away, and you don't want to do that because you want everyone to step up with the skill set that they've got in their backpack and feel confident that they're bringing their unique skill set. Also, once you start training, then you'll start to see the same things across all 10 people that you've trained them to do, which is not what we're interested in doing. We're interested in looking at what they do when the plane crashes and they have to survive on their own. So we're very careful not to train, but when it comes to the camera gear, we trained as intensely as we could. But to be honest, it was only like 3 half days of training how to use your camera, the basics of storytelling, the importance of two cameras, which some people didn't get all the time. Yeah. Two angles, people. and then just the tech, which, as you can imagine, is a joy. You've got several different types of camera, a microphone, safety gear, and you need to make sure they're always charged and working. So 3 days, 3 half days,
it's not much.
Not that much time.
No. This might be a bananas question, I don't know, but I mean, when you're crafting the episodes, are you picking who you highlight based on their filming ability or like the content they're sending back to you, or is it narrative driven? I mean, what are the decisions there?
It's narrative driven. It definitely is. This is the show that allows you to put poorly shot vision to air.
Sure.
And it's forgivable because it's an authentic series and that speaks to its authenticity. So we definitely allow the stories to unfold. You're almost working backwards from the winner to make sure that everyone gets as much airtime as you possibly can give them before they tap out. So you're almost constructing the show backwards from the end in terms of how you stitch those stories together. And it's a monster of a show to do that for. Our post executive producers and our post teams are just phenomenal storytellers in the way that they're able to do that. This series, for example, we had about 3,000 hours of vision. Oh, and 10 hours make it into the series. So you can imagine.
Mm. Okay, you've got, 10 people, whatever it is, 5 hours a day, 35 hours each a week. Like, that's a lot of footage a week. How do you sift and sort through that from when it turns up in production?
There's a twofold process. So there's the immediate production, that's sifting through that as quickly as we possibly can. And it takes time to sync all that footage and audio up. So we're looking at a very rudimentary version of what we call the rushes in the field, and that's so that we can see what's happening out there and make sure that everyone's okay and that they're safe. We're looking at you medically. We're looking at you in terms of your story crafting. We're looking at you in terms of you doing the right thing out there. But that footage is then looked at in detail once it gets to post. So you'll have a post producer who watches everything before they start cutting the show together. So there's two phases. There's the scanning phase and then there's the detailed gold mining phase.
So one of my questions was about that, because I know for sure that I absolutely accidentally flashed the camera badly a couple of times when I was running around without my...
Definitely accidentally.
Okay. I really did not want my gigantic whale ass on camera. And I can remember just turning around going, oh, my God, to the camera, I'm so sorry. Someone's going to have to watch this. So who's the poor sod that has to actually catch that footage, and did they take stress leave afterwards?
Yes and yes. That's the edit assist, who might have screamed when that happened. I may have had to run over to him to check what was wrong, and we quickly put those in a private bin to make sure that they didn't get seen anywhere else. He was quite young too, so I think it might have been his first naked body.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
But he's okay. He's recovered.
Do I have to send him chocolates?
He's only into, older women now who and his favourite colour is khaki. So it's changed him for the better.
Okay. Great.
You've already told us that narrative is kind of what helps set the structure of the show, and that, thousands of hours of footage is ending up on the cutting room floor. And in that, you must be leaving out a lot of important things that happen to people that just don't make the final cut. How does that affect the final product when you have to leave so many important things out?
It's super, super difficult. There are milestones in everyone's journey, and those milestones might be food procurement. They might be insights into themselves. It might be a struggle. It might be a fail, or it might be a win. They're not always represented, because some people have so many wins that it's impossible to include them all, or they might have so many fails it's impossible to include them all. But we try to make sure that their journey is represented by those pinpoints that have actually changed their journey or affected their journey or marked their journey. Imagine it's just as hard as someone who's writing an autobiography. You have to choose the parts that tell your story essentially as accurately as possible, but you can't include everything. And that's, to be honest, that's what I'm excited about the podcast for, because I feel like some people aren't with us very long on air, but as producers, they become our friends. The participants become our friends. They have to, because with this amount of risk in making a series like this for everyone, for them, it's their lives, it's who they are. I think you said it best when you said nature breaks you open, and it does. So they have to trust the people who they're breaking in front of, and we have to trust that they're going to roll on that. We have to trust that they're going to deliver. So you develop so much trust, and in that process you learn so much about them. This podcast, hopefully for me anyway, I really hope that this gives the fans a chance to meet them and to get to know them, because some of them didn't get to tell their stories out there. They weren't there long enough to share who they are, and they're all remarkable people. Mm. They're amazing.
You've seen it all with this show. What do you think makes a particular participant successful?
It's never just one thing. It's a combination of things. For the most part, those who last longer than others, the pattern that I'm starting to see is that those people are comfortable in their own company. They're people who are able to sit with discomfort. They're people who are able to sit with discomfort with themselves, and potentially people who have experienced that silence and that isolation previously. And resilience, people who have overcome are people who can overcome again. And so there's levels of Teflon, and there's a horsepower that you get when you've gone through something really tough. And it's also, it's a mindset. It really is. You can have all of those things and all those experiences, but it's all about why you're there. And I imagine you have to recalibrate all the time. You might have to decide each day what your mindset's going to be. From people that I've spoken to, even on other series, it's that daily decision. One more day, one more day. Often if you've got a goal in mind, that goal can really throw you. So if you go day by day, often I think that that mindset seems to be the more successful one.
I can imagine you've put people out on the landscape. It's this massive risk. You don't know how they're doing. You can get a red button call at any time. You're emotionally connected to them because you're getting these rushes in and seeing them in their process. It must be so stressful, the whole process. Like, is it stressful across the board? Are there some people who are just like, nah, this is fine? Or is production basically just hanging on by their fingernails?
Exactly that. I think we all are. And then you've got production on the ground hanging on by their fingernails, and then you've got everyone back in Sydney or in Australia also hanging on by their fingernails. So you're reporting back to them all the time. It's a terrifying series to make. I mean, quite literally, it could be life-threatening in terms of the things that can go wrong. The thought of a branch falling on someone while they're sleeping is always in the back of my mind. I'm waiting for that red button alert. I sleep with a satellite phone on my pillow. I'm ready to respond at any given moment. It's really scary because you care about the people, and you also care from a duty of care point of view. You want to make sure that you're ready to go, but you also care about them as people. It's almost like having your children out in the wilderness and worrying about them 24 hours a day.
And with that, is there ever that thing as a parent where you're like, okay, that's enough. It's too much. It's too hard. We're calling it. This is ridiculous. Why are we even doing this? Do you have any of those moments of going, why on earth am I doing this? Like, let's just pull the pin on the whole thing.
All the time. Look, if it was up to me, cause I think I'm more of a protective parent, I'd probably pull people out personally really early on. Some of them at drop off, just get back in the boat. But it's not up to me. It's a doctor who makes those decisions in terms of if someone needs to be pulled. So, you know, that's a rigorous process. And it's that push-pull, because you sort of go, this person's frail and they're struggling and I can see they're at breaking point, but they haven't hit breaking point. You have to hand over the onus to them and the decision to them. That's the whole point, right? That they can push themselves as far as they can possibly go.
That's the jeopardy of the show, isn't it, really?
It's the whole jeopardy of the show. Mm. So that fear that we are experiencing 24 hours in the lead up, during, and then sometimes post as well, during aftercare when they're still recovering, I think that's what makes the show exciting. If it wasn't so scary, it wouldn't be real. And if it wasn't so real, it wouldn't be so compelling. So that's just part and parcel of the show.
You've just had series one, and you would have learned so much from that, you know, hit the ground running, figure it out. And in the same way that when the participants land, they have all of these plans and all of these expectations, and then they land and all of the plans evaporate in the first day, I can imagine that there would have been a bit of that in production as well. It's like, wait, we've planned for everything, and then, oh, wow, we're here. You know, how much did you run into expectation basically just blowing up in the face of reality?
Quite a lot. I think what we learned from making season two is that every series is a season one.
Uh-huh.
When you've got 10 new people and a new location, everything's new. and you have to learn to pivot and you have to learn to learn very quickly. We were really lucky in making this season that we had so many crew that came on board locally. And because New Zealand has such a strong tramping culture, people are outdoors all the time. They know their landscape so well. So we had the luxury of knowledge and experience on the team. So that really made a big difference. But we were pivoting constantly and in shock constantly. And there was lots of WTF moments making this series.
How much local Indigenous involvement was there in this one?
Quite a lot. So during boot camp, we had our local Ngāi Tahu people, who are the iwi of the South Island. We had excellent consultation. During boot camp, we had some cultural awareness training. They helped us shape the series all the way from the start in terms of our cultural understanding of where we were, our understanding of language. There was a lot of language used in boot camp, which was fantastic. It was a really nice injection into the series, and it meant that our participants will talk about this. So when you're talking to people on the podcast, I'm sure they'll attest to this. A lot of them said they felt welcome onto the land because there was an official welcome before we went on, and it was an official welcome. It was beautiful. We went on to the marae and we had a porphyry, which is a proper welcoming ceremony, which is quite an emotional ceremony as well. So it was beautiful for all of us. But they, in particular the women actually, said that they felt really safe on the land and they felt welcome and protected, which was beautiful. I think that was its most impactful moment for us, to see that they felt safe.
Has anybody surprised you in this season?
You're trying to get a bananas out of me. I know what's going on here. Yes. Let me just say that there are more than 10 bananas in this series. Oh. Yeah, absolutely. This one more so than season one. I was surprised a lot. I was shocked a lot. As a production, we all were reacting and pivoting, as I was saying. People surprised us in terms of who did what and who performed in particular ways that we didn't expect, and how people cracked open. Lots of surprises. Mm. Yeah. I wish I could tell you.
I wish you could tell us too. No, but it's great going week by week and learning that with the rest of Australia. As an armchair loner, I, you know, often think about how long I would last out there and with the solitude and zero survival skills. I want to know how long you think you would last out there.
A lot longer than I would have pre-series one.
Sure.
Yeah, I've learnt a lot along the way. I've learnt a lot from these guys. Just watching them and absorbing, I feel like it's almost like I'm in my first year of uni, you know, in terms of survival, understanding how the land works, understanding how the psyche works, understanding how different approaches mean different things, even understanding priorities.
Mm.
But I would give myself probably about 4 days.
4 days. That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. What do you think it'll make you tap out?
Nighttime. I'm a true crime podcast junkie, so I will always imagine that there's a serial killer out there. And if I hear the slightest noise at night, I'm convinced that someone's coming to get me. It's humans. I'm scared of other humans.
I might have to take you out bushrooms, and we might just have to like light a fire and sleep out for a couple of nights and break that one for you.
Can I have my phone?
No, Rima, you can't.
What advice would you give someone who's considering participating in Alone?
Give yourself your own Alone experience. Do some research. Do some work to understand how to make yourself safe. But I would highly recommend, even if you just do one or two nights out alone, in the bush by yourself, if you can get through that, I feel like you've got room to apply for this series. You really need to actually have a go at it.
This is something that we're going to do with all the guests that we have on. We've got 10 quick fire questions for you. First one, everyone gets 10 items to take out there with them. What would be the first of your 10 items?
Salt.
What would be your biggest craving when you're in the wilderness?
Coffee.
Who's the person you'd miss most?
Oh, my partner.
What would you rather, season one Tasmania or season two New Zealand?
Bali.
Answer the question.
That's too hard. Maybe New Zealand, just because it's more open spaces and I'm claustrophobic.
Okay, maybe this will answer the next question too. Sandflies or leeches?
Oh, leeches, you can eat them.
Climb a mountain or swim a lake?
Swim a lake.
Baking heat or freezing cold?
Freezing cold.
Good night's sleep or good day's fishing?
Good night's sleep. Yeah, need your sleep.
One piece of advice you'd give someone as they step off the boat.
Watch your step.
If you had... What's your alone superpower?
Ooh, I'm a project person. So as long as I've got some kind of project to make, I can lose hours to a project.
So you can MacGyver your way through.
Yeah, I can MacGyver my way through. I can hyper-focus. That's my superpower.
Amazing. Well, you might just make it longer than you think, Rima. Thank you so much for coming in to chat with us.
Thank you so much. Good luck with the rest of the series.
Thanks so much.
I've just come out of the premiere for episode one of Alone Australia season two, and that was exciting.
It's captivating. I think it gives us a little bit of what we're all looking for in our daily lives at the moment. You know, we want to escape, but also it's just so beautiful.
I was like such a reluctant fan of Alone. My husband was watching it. I was like, I don't want to watch this. And then I got totally sucked in, and I'm here without him.
I'm hooked now. I need to see the whole series.
It was just amazing. I don't know what else to say.
I look like I could be in the wilderness, don't you think?
You look like you come straight from the wilderness.
Straight from the wilderness.
Yeah. Season one is very hard to measure up to. I mean, Gina is like the queen.
I do have a favorite, the one that survives at the very end.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're only one episode in. We've met five of our participants. Some people are kind of already picking their favourites. One of them seems to be Rick. He's a survival educator. He's a former SAS soldier. We've got him on the line to hear about what his thoughts were out there in the wilderness. I want to kick it off, Rick, by just asking what your thoughts were when you found out that you were going to New Zealand.
I remember the day well. That was the 10th of May. That was, yeah, a powerful day. I kept it quiet from the family into that evening, and then I snacked out and got a little bottle of champagne and just started opening it. And they're going, hey, what's that for? And then they're going, no way. And I'm going, yes, way. Yeah, I've just been told I'm on. So it was pretty exciting. Family are completely stoked for me, and yeah, it's good to have that energy in the house.
Beautiful. And what about when you found out that where you were going wasn't Australia, it was actually New Zealand?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been my first time to New Zealand before, but certainly the first time in the concept that you're going to have to look after yourself and be self-reliant in a fairly hostile country in the middle of winter, for sure.
Talk us through your expectations there versus reality on day one.
Yeah, I teach bushcraft and survival and that type of thing. So it's basically learning what to do in a contingency so you can get back into safety. This is quite different in the sense that there's some of that in there, but this is just that extended period. It's not like you're trying to get back to safety. You're creating safety around you and trying to self-sustain yourself in that environment. And yeah, it's somewhat daunting, but it had a comfort level too, in the sense that it certainly felt like an environment I had a lot of respect for. And so it wasn't that I feared it. I just knew I needed to respect it. Yeah.
Nice. How do you feel about drop shock? You know, how was that for you? Was it a thing at all? And if so, how did you manage it?
No, I remember that particular morning very well. And it was almost the opposite. It was like a level of calm that came over me as we were driving to the location to hop into the boat, obviously not seeing anybody else apart from the essential crew, and just that long boat ride to the location. And it was a real calm, like a meditation.
And then when you landed, though, that moment when you land and then the boat leaves and the enormity of what you've just signed up for, you know, drops on you, that's, you know, how was that?
Well, it wasn't actually so much of a shock. I probably expected it to go like that, you know, that, oh my God, what have I done? But it was like, here we go. This will be great. I felt comfortable with it. I felt like it felt reassuring to step on that ground. And I tend to feel that I tune into an environment pretty well. And I took my boots off and buried my feet into the gravel on the beachfront there. And it felt good.
You also had a bit of a swim as well. What was that like going in the chilly waters? And also, why did you do that?
It was to calibrate myself to this new environment that I'm in. Coming from Queensland, the water, although it can be cool in the wintertime, it is in no way of comparison as to what it was like in the South Island. And so it was just that welcomed reality check as to this is your new home. Embrace it, improvise, overcome, adapt, and learn to deal with where you are.
Now, take yourself back to that very first day, when you landed on your little beach and you got that amazing view, you've jumped in the water and you're met with clouds and swarms of sandflies. What was that like?
Yeah, certainly a shock factor to know that they're not going to go away, that I would need to adapt to them more so than try to control them. There is no way of controlling them. It's just a case of getting used to it. So that first day was a real reality check. This will be the long haul, yeah.
So what are your priorities on that first day?
Certainly shelter, not having any idea as to what was going to be rolling over those hills or mountains around me. It gave you very little warning as to what was coming, and so it was going to be shelter as the first priority, and then securing drinkable water in the hope that that water would be good quality, but I wasn't prepared to risk it initially, so it was about making sure that I could make it drinkable.
So depending on what time you get dropped out, which is, of course, a lucky dip, you've only got a certain amount of hours to do all of that. And it sounds like your priorities were shelter and water. So that's a lot to get through. How did you go in real life when the rubber hits the road?
Yeah, I was happy with how it went. I was probably quite happy with the fact that I found a location that I was more than happy to call home. I could certainly have a look around further on and see if there's anything more suitable. But I was in an area far enough away from the water's edge. I had no major deadfall above me. It was a clear enough area to set up my shelter for the size that I needed. And so that was a real bonus to be able to start working on a shelter. If I can protect myself from the weather, then the other priorities get a little bit more flexibility with them. I didn't intend getting a fire going on the first day. I was well hydrated and I had some water that was trickling out of a dirt bank there that I knew was good quality. It wasn't any bodies of water that I was suspect on. So I had two of the major priorities squared away, I think, very early in the piece, which was reassuring.
Rick, I really got a lot out of your personal mantra that you delivered to the audience. It seemed like you were really focusing on centering yourself there. But I was wondering, are you ever thinking about the other participants and what they're doing while you're out there? Is your mind on them or is it more on what's in front of you?
No, it was on me. My mind didn't go to the other competitors really at all. Certainly not on arrival. No, it was all about me and me getting comfortable. And as you say, an element of mantra, just that self-talk just to keep your own confidence level in your headspace and as to where you want it, not let it wander off, not let it get distracted.
Yeah, did you get much of a chance to size up the competition before heading out into the wilderness?
I think in some of the general conversation and looking at some of their hunting equipment and some of the conversations that you'll hear, I think I heard one of them saying that they'd been hunting with their father since I was 6 years old. And I'm thinking, okay, that's a bonus skill you're bringing to the table for sure. Yeah.
I had a question about your wife. I think it was her 60th birthday in those first day or two that you were out there. Was that right?
That
must have been really challenging.
It was, but we've got a beautiful relationship, and it was certainly discussed before I left. And it's you can't let this opportunity slide by purely because I've got my 60th. It's we can celebrate when you get back. My sons were going to be with her, and they were going to fly to Perth and catch up with good quality friends and family over there. So I knew that she was in a beautiful place, and her mind would be distracted for the fact that she's around people she can't say a thing to about where I am, apart from, Rick's running some programs or something in the bush, as he often does. But, the reality was she didn't know whether I had food in my stomach or whether I was wet or whether I was cold or how I was going. But, I was a couple of days in at the time when Neryl had her 60th birthday.
Rick, look, thanks so much for joining us, mate. It's been really lovely to chat to you, and it's been so great to get to know you over the course of episode one. I really hope we get to chat with you later as the season progresses. Good luck, mate.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
Can't wait.
Thanks for joining us on this podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, email alonepodcast@sbs.com.au and use the hashtag AloneAustralia on socials. Follow us on your podcast app to catch all the upcoming episodes when they drop, and we'll see you after the next episode. Alone Australia, the podcast, is produced by SBS Audio, Carolyn Gates, Max Gosford, Joel Supple and Karen Okuda. Special thanks to Joseph Maxwell, ITV, Alone Australia's executive producer, Rima Dayer, and, of course, all the participants.